Good afternoon. For those who are first seeing this video or hearing this recording on DVD or MP3, the first few minutes of this recording are happening not live. That's because the original lecture, the first few minutes, were lost. I did point out in the beginning of the lecture that the source sheet has been changed. There were new sources added. If you're looking at the source sheet, which is found on the website, you'll notice that there are more sources. If you follow the source sheet, though, you should be able to follow the lecture as well. We ended off last week discussing Hadrian's final solution. That after the third final bloody war with Hadrian in the Roman legions, in which the Roman legions suffered greatly, and the 22nd legion was completely wiped out, 7 legions were involved, and Rome was put to the test. So much so, we pointed out that Hadrian was unable and unwilling to tell the Roman Senate the traditional greeting of congratulations upon his victory at Betar. Hadrian then implemented the final solution, his final solution. First, he tried to uproot the Jewish people from the land of Israel. He tried to change the name from Judea to Palestine, the name that would stick to the land of Israel, all the way until 1948. Indeed, the original mandate for Great Britain, for Britain, over Palestine was the mandate for Palestine. That name came from the Philistines. That was to uproot the Jewish connection. Hadrian changed the name of Jerusalem to Ayala Capitolina. And he, in place of the temple, he built a temple to Jupiter, the famous Roman god. He built the Cardo in the old city in order to show that this was a Roman city. And he only allowed the Jewish people to come back to Jerusalem once a year on Tisha B'Av. But that was not it. Hadrian tried to destroy the Jews spiritually. He banned circumcision, he banned teaching or studying Torah, and he banned any public observance of mitzvahs or customs. Hadrian tried to totally annihilate the spirit of the Jewish people. What he tried to accomplish was to make up for Vespasian's mistake. Because as we said in the beginning of last week, that Vespasian allowed Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai to escape Jerusalem at the end of the Great Revolt. And he allowed the Sanhedrin to exist in Yavna. He allowed for the Davidic line of Hillel with Rabbi Gamliel to exist. And he allowed the Tzadik Hador, Rabbi Tzadok, not to be killed, and in fact treated him for his 40 years of starvation, and he recuperated as well. Hadrian chased the Sanhedrin. In fact, the Sanhedrin had to go into hiding. And indeed, had Hadrian lived longer, most likely, we would not be here today. It's kind of like if Hitler would have been around for 10 more years, let alone to our very day, we would not be here. If Hitler would have beat Russia and would have knocked out Great Britain, there would be no more world Jewry. Had Hadrian lived just a few more years, he would have uprooted the Torah existence of Jews throughout the Roman Empire. Fortunately for us, Hadrian dies within 3 years after the Bar Kokhba revolt and dies in the year 138 of the Common Era. Hadrian is replaced by a much more benevolent, not only to the Roman Empire, but certainly to the Jews, Emperor Antonius Pius, who would rule for many years, and then by Marcus Aurelius, both of who would treat the Jews differently. Nevertheless, Hadrian's final solution put the Jewish people at alarm. That at this point they realized they were in danger of losing who they were. And indeed, in the days of darkness of Hadrian, it really looked black. If you were a betting man in the year 136 of the Common Era, you'd have to bet that the Jewish people were done. Like Carthage, like so many other great empires, they were finished. Nobody could have in their wildest dreams imagined that we would be here today, let alone several hundred years later. The Jewish people had been annihilated. You had Hadrian, the most powerful emperor of the world, proactively trying to uproot and destroy any remnant of Torah amongst the Jewish people. It was a time of depression. And in this time, there were certain great sages, some of whom we'll talk about tonight, who held the banner up high, who not only provided spiritual nourishment for their generation, but to our very day, we live from their words. That was Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi Akiva's chief disciple, Rabbi Meir, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, who was the author of the Zohar, the primary work of Kabbalah, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai's son, Rabbi Eliezer, who followed in his father's footsteps, and Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel, who was a descendant of the house of Hillel and a direct descendant of David. Jewish history, any history, is a history of people. The dates, places, and events are only to give social studies teachers or history teachers papers to grade. They only allow us to see, do you know, basic knowledge. They do not tell the story of history. They do not tell the story of the world. And certainly in the Jewish people, certainly Jewish history is not made up of dates and numbers, but of the great individuals who led and made the Jewish people. Amongst the many great figures in Jewish history, Rabbi Akiva arguably represents a combination of everything that is heroic about the Jewish people more than anyone else. At least he is one of the most, if not the most, beloved individual in Jewish history. He was so great that the Talmud in Menachos, Chaftes 29, compares Rabbi Akiva to Moshe Rabbeinu in the Jewish lexicon. That is the greatest compliment of all. What was so great about Rabbi Akiva? Why is Rabbi Akiva to our very day a source of inspiration? Firstly, Rabbi Akiva lacked lineage. Rabbi Akiva represents every man to speak, so to speak. He did not descend from Jewish aristocracy or nobility. He came from a family of converts. There is an opinion that his father is a convert, another opinion holds it's his grandfather, but one thing is clear. Rabbi Akiva is a direct descendant of the Jewish, of the arch enemy of the Jews, Sisera. Sisera, the general who tried to annihilate the Jewish people and who ruled over the Jewish people harshly for 20 years and who died in the days of Devorah, of Deborah, and who we mention about his mother crying on Rosh Hashanah, we blow either 100 or 101 shofar blows. Rabbi Akiva is a direct descendant of this Sisera. Rabbi Akiva, so to speak, is the person who comes from nowhere. He is Middle Israel. He is the individual who lacks yichus. Most individuals, if they know their great-grandfather was a murderer of Jews, if they know their great-grandfather was an arch-enemy of Jews, they don't walk around saying, I can be the next Jewish great. I'll be a great Jew. I'll be a great Jewish leader. Imagine in our day, if somebody was a descendant of Hitler, Yimach Shemo, would he go around saying, would he go around thinking that he could be great? Look at my yichus. Rabbi Akiva didn't let that bother him. He didn't look at his handicap of his lineage, of his pedigree. He looked, what could he do? The second reason why Rabbi Akiva was great, and the second handicap he had, is that Rabbi Akiva, who will ultimately be the leader of the generation, the leader of generations, Chazal, our sages tell us that Rabbi Akiva is Raish HaChachamim. He is the head of all sages. He is the head of all the sages of the Talmud, our students of Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva, until the age of 40, was unlettered and unschooled. this unlettered and unschooled individual would become as great as Moshe Rabbeinu. And I won't repeat the whole story because most of us know it. Rabbi Akiva at the age of 40 goes to the river and he sees a rock, and the rock had made a hole through the water dripping on the rock. And he said to himself, the Pasuk in Iyov, Yudalad Yutes 14:19, that water wears down rock. And even great stones are rubbed smooth by the force of water. This became Rabbi Akiva's motto. That just like water wears down rock, so too Akiva can become a scholar. Just like water wears down rock, so too every Jew can and will learn Torah. Just as water wears down rock, so too the Jewish people can and will rebuild the temple. And just like water wears down rock, so too the Jewish people will beat out Rome. We will outlive them. We will beat them because we connect to the greatest source of water, to Torah. When did Rabbi Akiva was risen to prominence? While still illiterate Jewishly, Rabbi Akiva meets the daughter of Kalba ben Savua, Rachel. Who is Kalba ben Savua?
And our sages tell us that he was called Kalba Savua because anyone who entered Kalba Savua's house left satiated. He would fill up everyone. He was a very generous, giving individual. One day, the daughter of Kalba Savua, Rachel, Rachel, meets Rabbi Akiva. And she looks at Rabbi Akiva, and actually there's more than one source, this, and she saw the refinement of his character. She saw how pure he was. Now, interestingly enough, the Talmud says that Rabbi Akiva was so frustrated when he was ignorant that he said if he saw a Torah scholar, that he would bite him. He had a chance. He'd bite him not like a dog, but like a donkey. Because a donkey breaks the bones. That because he himself was ignorant, at that time he had such a hatred of Torah scholars, even though he's such a refined individual, but it caused amongst himself a hatred. That hatred, which won't be discussed tonight, is always a constant tension. That when you feel out, that feeling of not being there could cause a hatred to those who are. Rabbi Akiva is told by Rachel that she wants to marry him on condition that he becomes a Torah scholar. And that's when Rabbi Akiva goes to this river and realizes that if water could make a hole in a rock, Rabbi Akiva could become a Torah scholar. Rabbi Akiva goes for 12 years straight without returning home to study Torah. Actually, according to most sources, he had a child first and then went for 12 years straight. He comes home after 12 years, and he hears his wife telling a neighbor. Of course, you know, there are always the yentas. Always be careful about the yentas. And there's a yenta, you know, yentas sometimes mean well, but they cause damage. So one of these yentas is telling Rabbi Akiva's wife, "Where's your husband? Good for nothing. Leaves you for 12 years? What kind of husband is that? Do you know my husband? He makes me supper every night, takes care of me. What good is your husband? What kind of husband leaves a wife for 12 years? Rabbi Akiva's wife, Rachel, says, if he would listen to me, he would go for 12 more years and not come back until after 24. Rabbi Akiva, who overheard this conversation, does not even go into the house, turns around and learns for 12 more years. Now, if the sages say, why is that? Because had he stopped, there would have been a pause in his learning. But the tenacity, the water breaking, making a hole in the rock, the goal, being the driven, that was Rabbi Akiva. After 24 years, Rabbi Akiva comes back. He is the greatest sage of Israel. He has 24,000 talmidim. And he comes back to his wife. Now, Kalba Savua, who had disowned his daughter, disowned Rabbi Akiva, and they went into complete poverty, in the meantime had charata. He had regrets. Why did he disown his daughter? Why did, you know, very often in life, parents do things, and they realize the consequences even years later. And he felt awful for what he did. And he heard a great sage, Rabbi Akiva, was coming to the town. He figured he made an oath never to see his daughter and son-in-law again. He would go to the greatest sage of Israel who was coming to town and ask him to annul his oath, to be matter his nether. So he comes to Rabbi Akiva, his son-in-law, and he tells him, the Talmud says, that, you know, I regret what I did. I had a son, a daughter who's a beautiful girl, great in Torah knowledge. She married my ignorant shepherd. And in my wrath, I disowned her. And now it's 24 years later, I feel awful. I would like to annul my oath. So Rabbi Akiva asked him, well, if he wasn't ignorant, let's say he knew one bit of Torah, would you have disowned him? And Kalba Savua says, I give you my word. This shepherd had known one perek of Torah Shebaal Peh, had known one perek, then I would never have disowned my daughter and my son-in-law. So the Akiva says that your oath is annulled. I am your son-in-law. So at that point, Kalba Savua gave him half of his will, and of course, they were reconciled. Rabbi Akiva ultimately becomes a very wealthy individual. He was very poor. He gets wealth, the Talmud says, from three sources. He had half of Kalba Savua's wealth. The Talmud says he once found a shipwreck. And the third source is remarkable. He was a remarkable individual. Rabbi Akiva lived for 120 years, like Moshe Rabbeinu. Compared to Moshe Rabbeinu, his life spans 120 years, like Moshe Rabbeinu. It's questionable if he died on Lag BaOmer. That's according to many sources. He died on Lag BaOmer. One of the things that is celebrated at Lag BaOmer is Rabbi Akiva's death, or Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai as well. But the third source is he ends up marrying, after his wife dies, Rachel dies, with 120 years, with a long life. He ends up marrying the wife of a convert, or the wife who converted. She was the wife of Tyrannus Rufus, the governor at the time of Hadrian, who destroyed Jerusalem with Hadrian. His wife had seen Rabbi Akiva, saw the greatness of Torah, converts, and ultimately marries Rabbi Akiva. And the governor's whole fortune ends up being Rabbi Akiva's fortune. This governor, who Sage says many times dealt with Rabbi Akiva, his fortune ends up being Rabbi Akiva's fortune. Rabbi Akiva is not known for his material wealth. He's known for his spiritual wealth. Rabbi Akiva, our sages tell us, the Gemara says in Chagiga and in Nedarim, that there were four sages that went to the Pardes, to this world, this metaphysical world. And three sages went off. One went insane, one died, and one became a heretic. Rabbi Akiva was at such a level, he was able to go to the highest world and retain his greatness and even become greater. He was the greatest of the sages, and we'll see in a minute or two that nothing was able to stop him because he lived with his motto that whatever and anything is possible. Rabbi Akiva always saw that same thing he saw as a 40-year-old shepherd, that water can make a hole in a rock, that nothing is set in stone, that even the descendant of Sisera could be the leader of the Jewish people. Even a shepherd who knew nothing at age 40 could become a great Jew. Rabbi Akiva was the one to say, "Zekal Golda B'Torah V'Ahavta L'Riacha Kamocha." This is the general principle of the Torah. You have to love your neighbor as yourself. Chazal tell us that Rabbi Akiva was the Gabbai Tzedaka. He was the one in charge of giving tzedaka to others. Not only did he give tzedakah, he was the person who influenced even the sages to give tzedakah. There is a remarkable Gemara how Rabbi Akiva got Rabbi Tarfon, his contemporary, to give even more tzedakah. Rabbi Akiva was the one who was able to look at Shir HaShirim, Song of Songs, and not see it as a crude Song of Songs, like some sages did, but to see the inner beauty of an individual looking to connect to Hashem. An individual looking to connect to his Creator. And Rabbi Akiva, of course, is famous for his statement, the Koman, the Avrachman al-Tav of it, that everything that God does is for the good. That whatever happens is for the good. And the Talmud says a famous story that Rabbi Akiva was once traveling at night at the time of the persecutions of Rome. And he went knocking on doors in the city, and nobody gave him a place to sleep. And he was forced to go to the forest. And with him he had a donkey, he had a rooster, and he lit a candle. That night, a lion ate the donkey. A cat ate the rooster. And the wind blew out the candle, and Rabbi Akiva was forced to sleep in the dark. If this would be us, stop for a minute and be honest with ourselves. We go to a city, time of urban persecutions. This is, you know, in the great outdoors. At this time, the land of Israel has wild animals. Nobody lets you in. You go to sleep in the forest, and everything goes wrong in that night. Most people, they would get upset, nervous. Many people would scream, I can't believe this is my worst day of my life. How could I do this to me? I'm the greatest sage of Israel. I mean, this is ridiculous. It's everything that could go wrong went wrong. Rabbi Akiva, calm, cool, collective, command the Avirah, command the Latav Alvin. Whatever God does is for the good. That morning, of course, the Talmud says, Rabbi Akiva came to the town which had been wiped out. And the Romans had come that night and destroyed the town. And Rabbi Akiva said, had I been in the town, I would have been killed. Had I had my rooster and it would have made noise, the Romans would have heard me. Had I had my donkey and it brayed, the Romans may have killed me. And had they seen my candle, they would have seen where I was. They also would have killed me. Everything God does is for the good. The Talmud says at the end of Makkos that the sages on Tisha B'Av went to Har HaBayis and they saw the temples destroyed. And they all started crying. And Rabbi Akiva was laughing. So they said, Akiva, how could you laugh when you see our temple destroyed? So Rabbi Akiva, the person who always saw good, even in the time of dark, the person who could see a rock being penetrated by water, said, now I understand what the sages said, that there would be a day of when boys and girls would play in Jerusalem. That had a temple not been destroyed, we would never see that prophecy. But now that I see the prophecies of the temple being destroyed, which Yirmiyahu and Isaiah have prophesied, now I know that the prophecies of Zechariah and others will come true as well. And there will be a day sooner than our time, when we should be able to see the temple be rebuilt. But Akiva was the one who never gave up hope. In a time of complete despair. I mean, you have to imagine when Akiva is sitting there laughing, he's in Auschwitz 1944. Can you imagine somebody looking at Auschwitz and seeing Lakewood Yeshiva? Could you imagine somebody being there and seeing this is there's going to be a future for us? Do you know the strength of character, the depth of faith, the good eye that a person needs to see that in the gas chambers of Auschwitz? Rabbi Akiva was that person for the Jewish people. He was a person who no matter what, never gave up. Who no matter what, always saw the good. And who no matter what, believed in the eternity of Torah, believed in the eternity of the Jewish people. After Bar Kokhba falls, in 135 of the Common Era, as I mentioned, there was the final solution of Hadrian. Rabbi Akiva had backed Bar Kokhba. Rabbi Akiva had lost, this Chazal tells, all 24,000 of his students, and he was almost 120 years old. He could have said, enough. I give up. I can't go on anymore. I'm at the end of my life. What does God want from me? Rabbi Akiva went back and taught five students again. Rabbi Akiva even then didn't give up. And he taught five students, and of those five students, thousands more came. Rabbi Akiva's students did what Bar Kokhba could not. They ultimately outlived and beat Rome. When Rabbi Hadrian had his terrible decrees, including not studying Torah, death sentence. Death sentence for any Jew who studies or teaches Torah. Who was the first to go out to teach Torah? Rabbi Akiva. And of course the Talmud says at the end of Brachos that Pappas sees Rabbi Akiva teaching Torah one day. He says, Rabbi, Pappas was his friend. What are you doing? You're going to get yourself killed. So Rav Akiva gave him the analogy of a fish out of water. He says, we're a fish, we need our water. We can't live without it. And he says, the Jewish people will survive, you'll see. But I'm going to teach Torah. A few days later, Rav Akiva was actually caught teaching Torah and he was thrown into the jail. Concurrently, Pappas, who had been in the, Holocaust, he was doing black market, he was a good guy, but it was black market, he was trying to get around Rome, was caught for being involved in the black market. And he ended up in jail. When Pappas sees Rabbi Akiva, he says, Rabbi, praised are you. You're going to die teaching Torah. Woe is to Pappas. I'm going to die for what? For black market trading. Rabbi Akiva, of course, goes out to the Hippodrome in Caesarea. Now, the Hippodrome is there to this day. If you go to Caesarea, you can see the Hippodrome. It's one of the only, like, four or five in the world that's left of the Hippodrome, so, with its Colosseums where they had gladiators and all the things we discussed last week. So Rabbi Akiva was taken publicly to the Hippodrome, either on Erev Yom Kippur or Yom Kippur of 136 of the Common Era. And our sages tell us that he died, he was combed, his flesh was combed. And as he dies, he sang Shema Yisrael. And his students asked Rabbi Akiva, said, Rebbe, so much? He said, my whole life I waited for this. My whole life was to say Shema Yisrael in the name of God, even as I would die. That was Rabbi Akiva. Even on the day of his death, he was always able to connect that to realize the eternity of Hashem, that anything could be possible. Rabbi Akiva, of course, died that day. And according to legend, Rabbi Akiva was taken by Eliyahu and buried in Tiberias. If you go to Rabbi Akiva's kever, it's not in Caesarea, it is in Tiberias. It's in Tiberias. Actually, the Ramchal, who we'll discuss in quite a while from now, is buried right near Rabbi Akiva. But Rabbi Akiva really didn't die. In each one of us, we have Rabbi Akiva. Every word of Torah to our day is because of Rabbi Akiva. Every Gemara, the essence of the Jewish people, we are only here because of Rabbi Akiva. And Rabbi Akiva was the one who gave the Jewish people the hope, the will to survive, and the knowledge that no matter where, no matter what, it will be the pogroms, the crusades, the Alomahads in Morocco, the Holocaust, we will overcome. We can always see the good even in the dark. That the Jewish people are eternal and that Torah will always be learned. And that's why the Jewish people treasure him. Rabbi Akiva was the hero of heroes. He had the warmth, the humanity, the goodness, and the hope that Judaism is always symbolized by, which is the essence of the Jewish people. And Rabbi Akiva is the one who prepared us for the exile. Rabbi Akiva was the one who always reminded us that look at our day and time, and if so many people come from different directions, that water could always make a hole in stone. Who could have imagined, after a Holocaust, you'd have tens of thousands of Jewish boys studying yeshivas today? That you'd have literally, millions of Jewish people coming back slowly to Torah. Hey, who could have imagined in 1945 anything that's today? Rabbi Akiva's greatest student is also one of these individuals who was a key individual in rebuilding the Jewish people after the Holocaust of Hadrian, after the Third Roman War. Probably one of the most enigmatic individuals in Jewish history. His name was Rabbi Meir. Rabbi Meir, which we don't even know his real name, the Talmud questions, was it Rabbi Nechemiah? Was it Rabbi Naharai? He was called Rabbi Meir because Rabbi Meir means light. Rabbi Meir was also a descendant of non-Jews. Rabbi Meir, believe it or not, was a direct, this is not that far off, descendant of Nero. The Emperor Nero's great-grandson was Rabbi Meir. Now, you have to know, if you look at Roman historians, Jews were kicked out of Rome. And this would, of course, key into early Christianity. Rome was a very pagan, violent society. Judaism, when the culture conflict would come, people were impressed with Judaism. And some of the greatest Roman minds, I mentioned last week, Uncas came. Some of the greatest Roman minds joined the Jewish people. Ultimately, though, it was not for the masses. Christianity would tap into that and make it user-friendly for anyone to join. But you have to imagine there were many great minds that came into the Jewish people then. One of them was Rabbi Meir's parents. So Rabbi Meir is a direct descendant of Nero. He also comes from that background. But he is the bridge. Rabbi Meir was the bridge from the post-Holocaust generation. He was the Rabbi Aaron Cutler. Coming after, just for a contemporary analogy, the Rabbi Aaron Cutler coming after the Holocaust and beginning the seeds to build seeds of the Torah in America. Whenever, you know, you read Rabbi Aaron Cutler's life, everything was build. Rabbi Elia Meir Bloch was another one. He built Tells. Rabbi Elia Meir Bloch, I want you to understand how great this individual was. He lost his wife and kids in the Holocaust. They were murdered in 1941 in Tells. Now, he did not have accurate information of that until 1945, until after the war. He assumed they were dead. But there's a letter he writes. Now, the halakha is, if you know people pass away after a long time, and you find information years later, you only sit Shiva for a moment. There's no actual Shiva. So Rabbi Elia Meir Bloch said in this letter, he said, I just found out, confirmed my wife and children were killed, and this is the state in Tells. He said, I sat for the moment, and I truly mourned. But now I must go on. I have no time to mourn. I must build. And that is what he did. I must build. Rabbi Meir was in that generation. He was the bridge. The Talmud said that Rabbi Meir was the greatest, the most brilliant of his generation. Interestingly enough, we don't generally paskin like Rabbi Meir. He was too brilliant. People couldn't understand him. It's interesting today, even some of the greatest minds are not the greatest yeshivas. Because if you have information which nobody can understand, and you can't communicate it, so it's hard to follow it. I mean, if it's too deep for even his peers to understand, great peers, that's why the halacha does not follow Rabbi Meir. Beyond that, Rabbi Meir had a second teacher. And this is a contrast I want to make. Rabbi Meir's second teacher was Elisha ben Avua, also known as Acher, the other, or another. Elisha ben Avua was one of the greatest sages who became a heretic, who lost his faith. And there are a couple of reasons the Talmud says. One is, he once saw somebody doing the mitzvah of Shiluach HaKein, chasing away the mother bird before taking the baby, which the Torah says merits a person a long life. As this person chased it away, he fell down the tree and died. And he lost his faith. Another reason the Talmud says is he saw his Rabbi Chutzpis, who was one of the 10 martyrs, who we mourn for on Tisha B'Av and Yom Kippur, who is known as the Golden Tongue. He had his head beheaded. I said, how could this chutzpis have his tongue removed? He who spread so much Torah. Elisha ben Avua was the opposite of Rabbi Akiva. I never saw this, but I always thought this. Then why did Rabbi Meir have to learn by both? He learned by the Rabbi Akiva, and he learned by his opposite. Elisha ben Avua was the person who saw Auschwitz and got turned off, and who gave up, who became a heretic. He said, it can't be that God could run the world and let these things happen. Most of the rabbis left Acher. Rabbi Meir was the exception. Rabbi Meir, the Gemara says, and Chagiga said, I only eat the fruit and I discard the peel. Okay. Rabbi Meir after Acher dies, actually before that I should say, he was once walking Acher on Shabbos, speaking to the Torah, and they got to the Tchum, the border for Shabbos. And Acher, who was the old-fashioned, heretic. Not today, heretics don't know anything. In those days, the heretics knew something. Today, Reform Rabbi is an Amoritz. He doesn't know anything to be a heretic. He's a heretic, but he doesn't know why. But in those days, these were geniuses. 130 years ago in Lithuania, you had people who would desecrate the Sabbath, who knew Shas. This is, so Acher is going to the border, speaking to Rabbi Meir and learning. And he tells Rabbi Meir, you have to turn around now. We're getting to the Tchum Shabbos. You can't go beyond this point. Return to your place. So go back. So Meir says, well, just like I'm going to go back and not cross the home shots, why don't you come back with me? Why don't you return and do tshuva? So Acher says, Elisha ben Avuah says, I can't. I already heard a heavenly voice saying everyone can do tshuva, but for Acher. And our sages say that really was a test. The Rabbi Akiva of the world would have came back. Because Rabbi Akiva was a person who saw that even in Auschwitz, even after Hadrian, even when I'm 40 years old and unlettered, even if I'm the grandchild of Sisera, it doesn't make a difference. You can always come back. It's never too late. Everything is possible. Ultimately, Rabbi Meir himself redeems, the Talmud has a very long story, he redeems Acher from Gehenna, and he said that if God won't take him out of Gehenna, I'll take him out of Gehenna. That was Rabbi Akiva. That was the strength of Rabbi Akiva. And I really believe, I never saw this, but I always believe this, and I don't believe this, I think it's true, that Rabbi Meir learns from both to teach us that the example is Rabbi Akiva. That the example ultimately is Rabbi Akiva who was able to see Auschwitz and see the good, who never gave up, who saw that the rock could always be broken. You can always make a hole. Rabbi Meir is also known as Rabbi Meir Baal Hanes. Rabbi Meir, the master of miracles. Why is Rabbi Meir known about that? Well, the Talmud tells a story of this appendage to his name. After the destruction of Beitar, as I mentioned, Hadrian had very, very harsh decrees. He took Jewish girls and he put them into brothels. One of the Jewish girls that he put into a brothel was the daughter of Hananiah the Tradion, one of the greatest sages of Israel, also one of the 10 martyrs. Hananiah the Tradion was also the father-in-law of Rabbi Meir. Rabbi Meir married Hananiah ben Tradion's other daughter. So his sister-in-law got thrown into a brothel. And he went and he snuck in and he pretended like he was a Roman who was going to patronize. He asked for this girl in particular. And he goes over to her, and he says, how about you and me? He's testing her. And she starts using excuses, and this and that. And it was clear to Rabbi Meir that she had not slipped up. And then he reveals himself. That I'm your brother, I'm Rabbi Meir. He takes off his costume. He says, I'm going to get you out of here. Now this, by the way, is the trait of Rabbi Akiva. This is the consistency of Rabbi Meir. That no matter what, it can be in a brothel, I'm going to get you out. You're in Gehenna. Don't worry, I'm going to get you out. Don't give up. We're going to do it. This is the story of the Jewish people, and this is why these people are the ones who build Torah Shebaal Peh. These are the ones who bridge the post-Halas and would be the soul of the Gemara. These are the soul of the mission, these Rabbanim. Rabbi Meir says, I'll get you out. So he goes to the guard, and he offers him an outrageous sum of money to free his sister-in-law, the daughter of Hananiah ben Trajan. Now, of course, in good old Roman terms, I'm very happy to take the money, but I can't let her out. If they count the amount of prostitutes, and your sister-in-law is not here, they're going to have my neck. So Meir says, don't worry. If they come for you, just say, Aloka, the Rabbi Meir, the God of Rabbi Meir should protect me. Say those words. So he doesn't believe him. He says, I'll prove it to you. So this Roman guard of the brothel had two ferocious dogs, two huge dogs. He said, sick the dogs on me. And he's only too happy. He lets the dogs jump. And there says, Aloka did I mare on 80. The dogs stop. Guys, flabbergasted. The dogs stop in midair. And he then believes her in there. And he takes the money happily and he lets her go. And Ramir takes his sister-in-law and he escapes with her. Shortly afterwards, they come looking at the, you know, like Havdol, like the Havdol, the Nazis. They counted the barracks. You know, they have the right amount of girls here. And they were one short in this brothel. And they tell the Roman guard, well, what happened? You're one short. And he says, Aloka Rabbi Meir Aneini. Aloha Rabbi Meir Aneini. The God of Rabbi Meir should answer me. And he immediately he flies out of there when he says that. He sees this happen, he converts. The Talmud said, he converted, this guard converts and became a Jew, and he was not only the God of Rabbi Meir, became his God as well. this actually, Allah the Remer Anini, Remer Balanes became, not only the name of Remer, became a famous charity. In 1860, Shmuel Salant, we will learn about Jerusalem in the 19th century, in a long time from now, but Shmuel Salant, Jerusalem was sparsely inhabited, but around 1820, 1830, the population starts going up and up and up. And by 1860, you had a relatively poor population with very little means of parnasa, of making a living there. And so they started a charity called Charity of Rabbi Meir Balanes. That became the number one charity in Europe. When people gave to charity, you know, they always gave to the Jews in Israel. That was historically, way before the Zionists or anything else. So 1860, the Charity of Rabbi Meir Balanes. And the minute it became, then you give charity, say, Allah to Rabbi Meir Anemi, and you give the charity. In fact, it's also a skula. It's a famous skula. If you forget something for lost objects, also to remember Remer Balhanes. Remer was married to a brilliant lady named Bruria. In fact, Chazal tell us that when Remer couldn't give a shir, she pulled down the curtain, and she didn't give the shir. Bruria was brilliant. And they had a very tough life. And at one point, they had a miscommunication. And according to some opinions, Bruria even committed suicide. Okay? Rabbi Meir, at the end of his life, was traveling the world. He was alone. And he died in Turkey. And his last word, I'll quote, translate the Talmud, "Bury me by the seashore, because the waters that brush the coast, this land, are the waters that brush the Holy Land. And those that are attached to something that are holy, which is our holy, the waters that touch the Turkey, touch the Holy Land. So if you bury me on the coast of Turkey, that water will touch the Holy Land's water, right? The waters that touch touch Turkey touch Israel, so these waters are also holy. Bury me on the coast." Our sages say that he was ultimately transported to Tiberias, which if you go to Tiberias today, Remer Balanes' kever is there, and he's buried on the seashore instead of Tiberias. But Rabbi Meir was the person who formed this bridge of the new world. He was the person who said that the waters are holy. We are going to connect from one world to another world. Rabbi Meir was that person who, like his Rabbi Rabbi Akiva, would never give up, no matter what, no matter what the circumstances. Rabbi Meir, even though we don't pasten like him, Mishnah, Stam Mishnah, is like, and they will tell you, Rabbi Meir. The regular Mishnah, if you don't know who the author of the Mishnah is, it's always Rabbi Meir. Look at source number one. I was looking for some kind of listen tonight. I found this on Wikipedia. It's not great, but it's doable. If you look, you have Hillel and Shammai. That's Hillel and Shammai are contemporaries of Herod. Okay, that's before, right about 50 BCE. So then you have Yochanan ben Zakkai, who was a primary disciple of Hillel. As mentioned, Yochanan ben Zakkai was a leader who took the Jewish people out of the first revolt. Yochanan ben Zakkai, and on the side of his Gamliel the elder, he was a son of Hillel, and he would be the Davidic line going down, the house of the Nasi. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai had two great students, Yeshua ben Hanania and Eliezer ben Hyrcanus, who had a student Akiva. Then you see Akiva as a student of Rabbi Meir. If you look on the other side of Rabbi Gamliel, the son of the elder, it doesn't say Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel comes next. Both Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel will connect to the bottom. That's to Judah Hanasi, Yehuda Hanasi, Judah the prince. Hey, Judah the prince. The third individual tonight we'll discuss is Yehuda Hanasi, Judah the prince, who will be the man to emerge to make his mark and ultimately bring down the Mishnah. Yehuda Hanasi was a student, as we can see from source one, of Yehuda Bar Elai, but Yosef and Yosef Bar Chalafka. However, interestingly enough, the Talmud in Erev and Daf Yud Gimel says that he attributed his own personal greatness in the Torah of seeing Rabbi Meir's back. He said, because he was still young when he came to the class of Rabbi Meir. He didn't really learn primarily about Rabbi Meir, but he said, all of my greatness is because I saw the back of Rabbi Meir. I saw the back in the lecture. Right? He was facing back here. All you have good seats, you see in the front. But he was in the back. He saw Rabbi Meir's back. is Rabbi Yehuda is tapping in to the greatness of Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, he was not Rabbi Akiva, and not Rabbi Meir in the sense of lineage and starting point. He was from nobility. He was a direct descendant of Hillel and King David. He was charismatic. He was wealthy. He was intelligent. He was brilliant in all ways. He was the person who was necessary to deal with not only the Jewish people, but the Roman emperors as well. And as God had it, as Hadrian died in 138, Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi was able to become very good friends with both Antoninus Pius and Marcus Aurelius. The Talmud says that Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi in particular had a very good relationship with Antoninus. Now, historians debate, who is this Antoninus? Some say it's Antoninus Pius. Others say it's Antoninus Marcus Aurelius, because Marcus Aurelius was also an Antoninus. Most historians say it was Marcus Aurelius, Antoninus Marcus Aurelius, which would make sense, because the Talmud talks about how Antoninus and Rabbi Akiva would always talk about philosophy, about life, Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, Judah the Prince, was the advisor of Antoninus. Well, if you look at historians, Marcus Aurelius was called the philosopher king. He is referred to as the philosopher king. Both the Ocasius, the biographer, his own biographer, referred to him as the philosopher king. The early Christians, Justin Martyr, Melito, also give the title. Listen to the words of Herodian on Marcus Aurelius. Alone of the emperors, he gave proof of his learning, not by mere words or knowledge of philosophical doctrines, but by his blameless character and temperate way of life. It was in this time, this moment of silence, of this kind of small golden age where Marcus Aurelius and Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi had such a good relationship, that at that time, Rabbi realized it's now or never to record the Mishnah. Now, in this time of chaos, it was more than just a time of chaos, we had peace. They realized that tomorrow, Rome can turn again. And they had suffered so much. But beyond the suffering, it was also a very new reality. And that is that the Jewish people had become dispersed. The land of Israel was slowly but surely losing its population center. First of all, there was no temple. People weren't that interested in coming to Israel. I mean, the Babylonian Jews weren't coming. Other Jews had went all the way to North Africa, to the little countries like Morocco, and Libya, even up to Spain, and the Jewish traders followed the Roman legions up to Gaul, modern-day France and Germany. And there are sites where historical evidence shows there were Jewish settlements 2,000 years ago in Germany and France. They had followed the Roman legions up, kind of like San Francisco, you know, the 49ers. The Jews were here with the 49ers. But as the Romans went up north, the Jews were there with them, selling and buying. So the Jews had become dispersed. And many, many Jews were going all around the world. And as opposed to having a central Jewish world where people can study, there is now a real Jewish diaspora. And the concern was that as Jews spread out, if you don't do it now, we're going to end up with 15 different Judaisms. In fact, within 150 years, there will be practically no Jews left in the land of Israel. Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi was prophetic in this, and he so sees the moment. He could have said, nothing will happen. I won't be concerned about it. I won't plan for tomorrow. Right now, me and Marcus Aurelius, we're best of friends. What could possibly go wrong? But he saw the reality of the world around him, and he decided to redact the oral law. He decided to redact the Mishnah. Now, one of the reasons why the oral law, the oral Torah, was never recorded, from generation to generation, because if it's recorded, it can become frozen. The Medrash Tanhuma and the Talmud and Gittin expound that the principles of the oral Torah stayed the same, but the application of these principles was meant to be adapted to all types of people and all types of circumstances. if you write it down, it's a danger of becoming frozen. In the old days, you had experts in all areas. I mean, there were Jewish scholars that would go through the oral law. There were notes. People had notes. But everyone became an expert, and you would pass it down. Individuals kept notes. Rabbi Meir actually was a notekeeper, the main notekeeper of his generation. The brilliance of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi is that he was able to start Mishnah by not freezing the law. By making it that the way Mishnah was crafted is we can figure out what to do today about a video camera or a car on Shabbos, what Jewish law will say about all kinds of DNA treatments, to medical procedures, to things which they never could have imagined, because it all will come from these principles. The way Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi and the sages crafted the oral law is they kept that reality of a living Torah. Not like conservative does, who doesn't take the Torah seriously, but with the principle of the Torah. Look at source number two. This is from Rabbi Aryeh Kaplan, the Handbook of Jewish Law, which is an excellent book, by the way, for those who want some not so light reading, but good reading. The oral Torah was originally meant to be transmitted by word of mouth. It was transmitted from master to student in such a manner that if the student had any question, he would be able to ask and thus avoid ambiguity. A written text, on the other hand, no matter how perfect, is always subject to misinterpretation. Okay, I can only tell you how many people, how often do I get, Rabbi, I read in a book so-and-so, and the person was doing something on the Sabbath or kashrus, even in a good English book with very explanatory, lots of notes, and people make mistakes, let alone very esoteric topics, much more complex topics, or applying one law to another law, because there's always so much you can write. There's always new grays and new permutations. I saw this law, so it must be, in this case, it would be applicable as well. And you give up asking to figure it out. If the entire Torah would have been given in writing, everyone would be able to interpret it as he desired. This would lead to division and discord among people who follow the Torah in different ways. The oral Torah, on the other hand, would require a central authority to preserve it, thus assuring the unity of Israel. In other words, no one was able just to get up and say, I know what the Torah says. It made it that you went to the Sanhedrin, you went to the rabbis, and you had one authority, it was one hierarchy of understanding the Torah. Look at source number three. So why do we write it down? Number 12. This is from the Maimonides, the Rambam's Introduction to Mishneh Torah. In the beginning of Maimonides' Mishneh Torah, which is his magnum opus, his code of Jewish law, he discusses the writing down of the oral Torah. Our holy teacher wrote the Mishnah. From the time of Moshe to our holy teacher, no one had written a work from which the oral law was publicly taught. Rather, in each generation, the head of the then existing court, where a prophet of the time wrote down for his private uses notes on tradition, the traditions he had heard from his teachers, and he taught to the public from memory. Skip to number 15. Why did our holy teacher do so and did not leave things as they were? Because he saw that the number of students was continuing to go down. Calamities were continually happening. Wicked government was extending its domain and increasing in power. And the Israelites were wandering and emigrating to remote places. He thus wrote a work to serve as a handbook for all, so that it would be rapidly studied and would not be forgotten. And throughout his life, he and his court continued giving public instruction in the Mishnah. This was an emergency decree, and they wrote it in a way of where it would not be locked in, right? Where we, the oral tradition. Now, a typical question, and this is why I wanted to deal with this, very often rabbi, if we had a strong oral tradition, right, and we pass from student to teacher, well, anyone who learns the Talmud, I remember in law schools, all these people who knew nothing of the Talmud would say to me, oh, that's so Talmudic. You knew that somebody said it to you, had no idea what Talmud was. It's so Talmudic, because usually it wasn't that profound. Talmud's a lot more profound than that. But Talmudic is hair-splitting, back-breaking, and arguing about lots of points. And are there many arguments? Now, guess what? There are no arguments about basic principles. Nobody argues, do you keep Shabbos? Nobody argues, do you keep pork? Nobody argues, could you, you know, not keep Yom Tov, or could you be with your wife at certain times a month? There are no major mitzvahs, none, zero major arguments. All of the arguments of the Talmud are primarily in rabbinic things, for the most part, and they're the minutia of the rabbinics. There are some things that get discussed in the biblical, but it's the minutia, it's the details. It's the how-to, the basic, there is never a disagreement about. Okay? And we'll see later that how remarkable that is. Look at source number 4. This is from the Ravid. There are 3 Ravids. This is Ravid number 1. Rabbi Avraham ben David, who wrote the Sefer Kabbalah, which is the chain of transmission. He was a 12th century Spanish sage. And if a person wants to claim, since the rabbis disagreed in several places, I cast doubt upon their statements. You must rebuke him and explain to him that the sages never disagreed about the principles of the commandments, but only regarding the details of their application. Skip. For example, the sages did not disagree about whether one should light candles for Shabbos. They were only divided in respect to the type of substances to be used in those candles. Okay? The Mishnah is broken down into 6 major basic areas of Jewish law, which cover the gamut of halakha. That is Zra'im. Zra means seeds, which cover all the agricultural rules, laws for foods, as well as the blessings. Moed, which is holidays, which deals with the Sabbath, Shabbos, and other Jewish holidays. Noshim, which means woman, which are examine all of the issues between man and woman, such as marriage, divorce, etc. Nezikin, which deals with tort, criminal, civil laws. Kachim, which means holy things, which cover all the laws of the temple. And Taharis, which means pure things, which went through all the laws of spiritual purity. There were 63 tractates of Mishnah, covering 525 chapters. Now, Rabbi Yehuda finishes the Mishnah approximately 190 of the Common Era, and in Sipori, which is in the Galilee, that's where he lived, and dies shortly after. Now, interestingly, most archaeologists, and they have actually found evidence of this, assume that Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi and many of his contemporaries are buried in Beit She'arim, which is not far from Sipori, and there was actually the previous place of the Sanhedrin. They found all kinds of caves with evidence that these people were buried around there. But Beit She'arim, actually, you can visit it. It's go to North Israel, you see a lot of these sites are still completely there, and interesting from an archaeological perspective. I just want to continue, I'm going to skip ahead a little bit today to the writing of the Talmud. Because the Mishnah was written in classical Hebrew. Mishnah is very easy to understand. Easy Hebrew, right? Mishnah Hebrew, it's written concisely. In many places, it's cryptic what the Mishnah is talking about. Because they didn't want to write down all of the oral law. Because again, once you write down all the oral law, you have a lot of people who abuse it and misuse it. And they're not going to go to the sages to do that. Haraya, the greatest proof is, after the Septuagint is translated to Greek, guess who pops up shortly later? All kinds of cult groups, including the early Christians, who have the Bible translated for them. Most pagans who convert to Christianity, they use the Septuagint, and they would then interpret it as they liked. Right? There is a danger of writing it down. The Talmud will continue the Mishnah's thing of having many things cryptic. So as much as written down, you still have to have a teacher. I personally have been involved in studying with some of the most brilliant minds from Ivy League universities, as in Philadelphia in particular, and you have PhDs who can't crack the Talmud. And people who are mathematical geniuses, science geniuses, history geniuses, if you don't have a Rebbe-Talmud relationship, it's very... I don't know what they were doing in times of Rome. So they have a very hard time. I once heard a story that there were 2 near Israel guys who were studying in Johns Hopkins in the library, and passed by them one of the great, I forgot what his name is, famous archaeologists who was at Hopkins. You know who was that? is very into biblical archaeology. So he said to them, he saw them studying. He said, you know what? I tell you the truth, I memorized Aramaic. And I've been trying, this is before art schools, in the 1950s. I've been trying to read Talmud. I can't figure it out. Can you explain to me what's going on? He was a guy who learns Aramaic. He couldn't figure what's going on. It still necessitates a Rebbe. Okay? Even, if, I can give you a tell. I learned yeshivas for many years. And when you speak to a great Rosh Hashiva, you'll see there's multiple levels of understanding things. There is tremendous depth, and there's lots of hidden messages in the Talmud. So even when we write it down, we still keep that element where you need a Rebbe, and that allows people not to misinterpret it, and it allows people to have that connection to the true tradition of Masoro. At the time of Yehuda Nasi, it was not yet necessary to write down Gemara, but things got increasingly worse. As you learn about next week, the early Christians would badger the Jews to no end. The yeshivas had harder times. And it came to the point in the 500 of the Common Era where they ultimately would write down the Gemara. But before that, Rehuda Nasi had a contemporary called Rabbi Chia. Chia is Aramaic for Chaim. Chia means life. Rabbi Chia was his nephew who wrote the Brises. Brisa means outside. Brisa is outside. And what Brisa do is they flesh out the Mishnah. So you had Mechia adding the Brisa, which came afterwards, and they fleshed out the Mishnah in that way. So when you learn Gemara, you'll see that there's lots of Mishnah and there's lots of Brises. Ultimately, the sages both in Israel and in Babylonia began to work on the Talmud, to write down the Talmud in the same way of the Mishnah, but to expand on it. In Israel, they started first. They got more nervous quickly because they had the early Christians there. Babylonia became increasingly popular because where they were at that time in Persia, there were no early Christians, and they had much more tranquility. The Jerusalem Talmud was actually not in Jerusalem. There were no Jews in Jerusalem. That edict of the Romans had not changed at all. It was written in Tiberias, in Tiberias, the home of the last home of the Sanhedrin. It was only called the Jerusalem Talmud because out of respect to the real home of the Sanhedrin, which was Yerushalayim, they called it the Jerusalem Talmud, but it was never written in Jerusalem. It was only in Tiberias. However, it ended short. They didn't get to finish it. It was much more cryptic. It's more difficult to understand. And the Babylonian Talmud, which was a complete project, which finished at the end, that became the bread and butter of what we study today. Now, the Jerusalem Talmud and the Babylonian Talmud go together. They're not in contradiction. The few places where they are, we follow the Babylonian Talmud. In the Talmud, there's not only the Halacha, there's called the Agadata. The Agadata has lots of stories, and many of these stories have the cryptic, theological, philosophical secrets of Judaism. And they were purposely hidden, some in stories which almost sound nonsensical, some in stories which are historical, some in stories which there's a simple meaning, but a deep meaning as well. That was also put there so people would have to learn by teachers. Okay, ultimately, we would end up with a Talmud which has Mishnah, and the Gemara, which means, Gemara means in Aramaic tradition, or in Hebrew, finished. It was the finished part, we have the Gemara and the Mishnah. Next week, we will see how important it was for this writing of the Torah down, that ultimately, the oral Torah, had it not been done at that exact moment, we would have lost our tradition. We were under tremendous pressures at that time for the Christians to assimilate. I want to just give a brief excursus about the oral law, about the oral Torah, because we were already discussing it. I want to deal with a couple of issues which are very commonly asked. Some of these sources you will not have, but I will update it, as I said, and you'll get it tonight or tomorrow. Common question, Rabbi, how do we know the oral Torah always existed? I can't tell you how often I get that question by secular Jews. Usually confused people who come from a somewhat background, because most secular Jews who don't come from any background never heard of the Oral Torah. You know, as I said 2 weeks ago, a lot of them have never heard of Jeremiah or Isaiah. They definitely didn't hear of an Oral Torah, of a Talmud. So how do you know the Oral Torah always existed? So I want to give one of the most famous examples, and that's from Devarim, Perakut Beis. Listen to how the Torah says the law of Shechita. I'm going to say it in English because you don't have the Hebrew in front of you. You may kill of your herd and flock, which the Lord gave you as I have commanded you, and you may eat within your gates after all the desire of your soul, as I have commanded you. What is this, as I have commanded you? Where do we find anywhere in the written law the law of ritual slaughter, the law of Shechita? You don't see it anywhere. What does it mean, as I have commanded to you? It's not in Bereishis. It's not in Shmos. It's not in Vayikra. What do you mean, as I have commanded to you? How do you do Shechita? How do we ritually slaughter? What was the Torah talking about? Hey, that is showing that most mitzvahs are as I have commanded to you. Another example, if you look at when we're given tefillin, listen to the verses on tefillin, and you shall place these words on your hearts and on your souls, and bind them for a sign on your hands, and they shall be frontlets before your eyes, totofos, between your eyes, and you shall write them down upon your doorposts of your house and upon your gates. What are tefillin? Are they red? Red tefillin? Are they circular? What's in the boxes of the tefillin? What are you writing down? What word? We have no idea what the Torah is telling us. What are tefillin? What is it referring to? Again, Ari Kaf, we don't have the source, but I'll have it tonight or tomorrow. Okay. There is no description of them, nor any hint as to how they may be made. The Torah was not meant to be a mere book lying on a shelf. It was meant to be part of the everyday life of an entire people. And as such, it could only be transmitted by the word of mouth. The oral Torah was handed down from teacher to disciple for almost 1,500 years, until the harsh Roman persecutions finally threatened to extinguish it completely. Finally, some 1,700 years ago, it was written down to form the Talmud. The Talmud itself cites tefillin as a prime example of a case where the full description of a commandment is found only in the Oral Torah. Now, when you think about it, when the Talmud is centered on the Jewish people, they had tefillin and they were ritually slaughtering. You don't find any debate amongst any of those laws. Nowhere in Jewish history, nowhere in Christian history, nowhere in any history book do you ever see the people question, do tefillin really look like this? Does this really have to look? It was completely the Talmud and the Mishnah at the two periods were completely accepted by the entire Jewish people. It would only be hundreds of years later that you'd have Karaites popping up for many other reasons which we'll discuss, saying, well, I don't know about this oral law. But when the Talmud comes out, and truth is, if you ever ask a Karaite, they have ritual slaughter. So you ask them, oh, you slaughter your animals. How do you slaughter it? They have no idea how to answer. And they can't answer any of these questions. Right? It's almost comical if you get into a conversation with them. Like, oh, you do. They rely on the sages themselves. But it was completely accepted. Right? And it was not any matter of debate amongst these topics. The point is that both the oral Torah and the written Torah were given concurrently. So how do they work together? Look at source number 5. This is of Sham Shimon for Al Hirsch, who had to deal with reform. One of the things, besides the written law that the Reform rejected, was the oral law completely. The written law, Reform contends to this day, is not for Moses at Sinai, but it's a Jewish book. It's a persuasive Jewish book. We learn a lot of cultural things. The oral law he didn't even deal with. So he first dealt with these people. Look at source number 5. The written law, the Torah Shebichsav, is to be the Torah Sheba'al Peh, in the relation of short notes on a full extensive lecture on any scientific subject. For the student who has heard the whole lecture, short notes are quite sufficient to bring back afresh to his mind at any time the whole subject of the lecture. For him, a word, an added mark of interrogation, or exclamation, a dot, the underlining word, etc., is often quite sufficient to recall to his mind a whole series of thoughts or a remark, etc. For those who had not heard the lecture from the master, such notes would be completely useless. If they were trying to reconstruct the scientific content of the lecture literally, from such notes, they would of necessity make many errors. What is Rav Hirsch saying? Rav Hirsch is saying that when we have the written law, we have the short notes of the great lecture given at Sinai. You can't understand the Torah by being a Christian fundamentalist, by just reading the Bible and reading the shorthand notes. You can't, you're going to make mistakes. Imagine hearing a brilliant lecture and writing down a few notes. Jim, you're into science, Chaim. And could you, if you had to make a few notes, would people misconstrue and make mistakes? They'd say an eye for an eye literally makes an eye. When it didn't mean an eye, I had a friend, I went to the store on Shabbos, who was a professor at Villanova. He's a brilliant law, he's a brilliant Talmudist, and he's a law professor as well. So they asked him to give a class at a Christian school, and he gets this Christian school, an evangelical Christian school, and they asked him to talk about the Talmud. So he goes to the Christian school, and he says to them all, how many of you know the Bible? Everyone raises their hand. We all know the Bible. And he says, what's the first commandment of the Bible? Fruitful and multiply. Everyone of these people are, you know, Christian fundamentalists. They read it. What does fruitful and multiply mean? No one raises their hand. One child, two children, three children, 40 children. Is it never enough? What does it mean? It's his first mitzvah. He said, if the Talmud tells you all of this and more, it explains everything. All you have in the written law is shorthand notes. A person who tries to understand Judaism with the written law, he's going to make mistakes. He's only seen part of the lecture. He's only seen the shorthand notes. Rabbi Aaron Kotler, the Rishu from Lakewood, used to say that the written law, Torah Shemechzad, is like a global map, seeing the big cities. And the street map is the oral law. You can't know where you're going unless you have the oral law. You're going to make grave mistakes. You're going to be missing the pulse of what it means to Jew. You're not going to know how to decide Jewish law. This, and I want to emphasize this, and I want to emphasize this again, is a crucial, crucial point to be made in history. The Gentiles, and not only the Gentiles, but Reform and later conservative Jewry are going to claim that Judaism changes at the time of Judah Hanasi, and a little bit before by Hillel. It's called Rabbinic Judaism. Until then there was Biblical Judaism, and then there is Rabbinic Judaism. You could look for any source. When I got that chart from tonight, I saw a thing. Rabbinic Judaism. Rabbinic Judaism. Like, there's a new Judaism that comes out, which is ridiculous. Because again, could you imagine the rabbis trying to convince the entire Jewish nation how to put on tefillin, how to ritual slaughter? It's impossible to make that. The Torah was always given as one. You never find it to be about any of these core issues. And even when the Sanhedrin passed it was universally accepted. Now, you don't find 40 different Jewish people. Ultimately, when you find Jews in Spain in the 7th century, you find Jews in Iran, you find Jews in Morocco, you find Jews in Gaul, they're all doing the same thing. And they weren't all convinced that in the 200 years earlier that this must be what you heard at Sinai. Right? The Torah was always given at once. The greatest fallacy, and these are for people who don't want to keep Torah mitzvahs, is to call it Rabbinic Judaism. It's a newfound Judaism. That is false. Right? The Torah, Oral Torah, there was no change but for Rabbi Yehuda Nasi being forced to lead the Jewish people to write it down. And the biggest proof is it was never a matter of contention among any of the Jews. There'll be no contention until many years later, again, until the Karaites come, and they'll disappear from history, but we'll learn about the Karaites as well. Look at source number 6. This is a beautiful source. This is from the Talmud in Shabbos 31a. We'll read the whole thing in English. We'll read the Hebrew later. Our rabbis taught, a certain heathen once came before Shammai and asked them, how many Torah kinds of Torah have you? Two, replied, the written Torah and the oral Torah. I believe you with respect to the written, but not with respect to the oral Torah. Make me a proselyte, a ger, on condition that you teach me, excuse me, the written Torah only. He scolded and repulsed him in anger. That was Shammai. When he went before Hillel, he accepted him as a proselyte. On the first day, he taught him Aleph. Second day, he taught him Bet. Third day, he taught him Gimel, Dalet, the first four letters of the Hebrew alphabet. The following day, he reversed them to him. But yesterday, you did not teach to me thus, he protested. Must you then not rely upon me? Then rely upon me with respect to the oral Torah as well. It goes much deeper. Do you know that if you don't have an oral Torah, you can't even read the words of the written Torah? Do you know that all Christians, anyone who reads the written Torah has to rely on the oral Torah? Because you can't, there's no vowels in the written Torah. And guess whose version they're all following? The oral Torah's version. The Septuagint is going to be based on our tradition. Otherwise, ches, don't eat ches, lam, and beis, and basar. What's ches, lam, and beis? What's ches, lam, and beis? It could be read as milk, chalav, or chalav, fat. How do you know what it means? Is it chalav? Don't eat meat and milk, or don't eat meat and fat. You have no idea. You can't even read the written law unless you have an oral tradition. There are no vows. If you're going to trust me by this, you got to trust me by this. Right? It's even much deeper. It means that the whole written Torah, you can't even open it. Just to look at the, number one, you have the Ohad source. This is also from Maimonides or the Rambam, Introduction to Mishneh Torah. All the commandments that were given to Moshe at Sinai were given together with their interpretation. Listen how the Rambam Maimonides learns the verse. As it is written, this is Exodus 24:12, and I will give thee the tablets of stone and the law and the commandment. Law is the written law, the commandment is the interpretation. We are commanded to fulfill the law according to the commandment, which is the oral, like Shechita, as I commanded. That is how you do Shechita. And I want to end with number eight. I mentioned tonight that we had three great scholars. We had Rabbi Akiva, we had Rabbi Meir, we had Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, who really preserved Torah for the Jewish people. We'll learn next week Judaism is going to change. It's not going to change spiritually, but the persecutions will become great. Next week we're going to pick up with the early Christians, and really the beginning of Christianity will go back to the beginning of Christianity and what that means for the Jewish people, because our next 1700, 1800 years is going to be with that reality. But what's going to keep the Jewish people, what has not only kept us spiritually as in the law, but the soul of the Jewish people, is going to be the Talmud. It's going to be this spirit of Rabbi Akiva, that the rock can be made a hole in it, that I'll always see the good, that the Torah is eternal. Don't worry when you're in Nazi Germany. Don't worry when you're in communist Russia. Don't worry when you're under the Shah or the Khomeini in Iran. Don't worry when your Marano's hiding in Spain in the 16th century. We will be victorious. Listen to the Rivera Wine is an inimitable. This is actually an article, 2005, the Jerusalem Post. Go to the source number 8. Go to the bolded part. Throughout Jewish history, the Jewish people in all of their lands of dispersion basically lived a Talmudic way of life, differing little from the ways of the lives of their ancestors in Babylonia during the period of the compilation and editing of the Talmud. It was the Talmud, naturally based upon the sanctity and integrity of the Torah, the written law that bound world Jewry together in spite of the enormous distances of space and society that exile imposed upon it. Skip to the next bolt. Even though the vast majority of Jews were hardly Talmudic scholars, this field was pretty much reserved for the rabbis and judges of Israel. Almost all Jews were aware of the Talmud, its values, messages, decisions, and stories. It was the guiding book in their lives, not only in matters of ritual law, but also in terms of personal behavior, societal goals, and vision of the Jewish future. It was almost as though through a process of osmosis that Jews absorbed within themselves an appreciation and respect for the Talmud. Eventually, it could be said that the book referred to in the phrase, people of the book, was the Talmud. It is no surprise, therefore, that the Talmud became the target and flashpoint of opposition to Judaism, its values and practices, as well as its practitioners. The burning of the Talmud was a regular part of Christian persecution of the Jews throughout Europe from the time of Louis the Ninth in the 13th century to Nazi Germany in the 20th century. Again, all those dissident Jews who rejected the traditions of the oral law and sought to create new forms of Jewish life also attacked the Talmud bitterly and discredited its ideas and formulations. From the Karaites in the 7th century to the Yevetzka, the Jewish section of the Bolshevik party, Jacob, if I have to say it afterwards, that Stalin would later purge in the 20th century, the Talmud was vilified and its pages torn and destroyed by Jews who were bitterly opposed to its teaching and who recognized that no new form of Judaism could ever take hold as long as the Talmud was still studied, respected, and loved within the Jewish world. Nevertheless, like the Talmud, Jewish people that it protects has weathered all storms. It is the main text and study and topic of study in all yeshivas throughout the Jewish world. Competence in its study is the first requirement for all rabbis and teachers who maintain and defend the veracity of Jewish tradition from Sinai until our day. The Talmud is old, but it remains fresh and vital. Its study is complex, challenging, but it is a labor of love. For understanding the Talmud is the way to understanding the Jewish soul, the Jew that is within us all, and that is our true connection to our past and to our destiny. This was the gift of the Akiva, of the Emir, of the Yehuda Nasi gave to us to connect our past, to build our future. Next week, early Christianity. Thank you.